this explicitly, so Psi is a spinner, so it has four components. Gammas are 4×4 matrices, and so the Dirac equation is the matrix operator acting on this column of four numbers giving zero. So it's not at all obvious that this equation is Lorentz invariant. And we started to discuss how Lorentz transformations act on the spinners. So Psi transforms by multiplication with some matrix L, which satisfies the condition that when the similarity transformation applied to the Dirac matrices should be equivalent to the Lorentz transformation on their indices. So in this sense, although gammas are given fixed numerical matrices, we can regard them as components of a vector because the transformation of the spinners induced, I mean, the transformation induced in gamma matrices by the transformation of spinners is equivalent to the Lorentz transformation of their vector indices. So to check that, we introduced, so we considered an infinitesimal transformation where the say angular rotation is very small. And then the matrices sigma should satisfy the following equation. So the commutator with gamma should be equal to okay, so I think I wrote it like that. So the indices were mu, nu lambda, and mu. And then this should give gamma g lambda mu gamma nu minus g nu mu gamma lambda. So this is, if you wish, is a defining equation for generators of Lorentz transformations in the spinner representation. So our task is to find the suitable 4×4 matrices sigma, and so they have two indices, two vector indices, and they are antisymmetric in these indices, so there are six such matrices. Okay, since they are antisymmetric, there is a natural candidate for such a matrix. And this is just a commutator of the Dirac matrices. Okay, so this this has two indices, and it is antisymmetric in gamma and lambda. So let's give this a try and see if it solves this equation. So if we compute, so we need to compute a double commutator. Okay, so this is just by definition, this is the double commutator of three direct matrices. So I'm going through this calculation in detail just because this is very typical of, I mean, the tricks one uses here are typical of the methods that one uses with direct, in dealing with direct matrices, one always uses the same technology, namely, we should use the defining relation of the direct matrices. In fact, since this defining relation of the direct matrices, which is says that the Arrhenti commutator is twice the Minkowski metric times the unit matrix, since it defines them almost uniquely up to similarity transformation, then it should be enough to do calculations with the direct matrices, and that's almost always true. So one doesn't need to know their explicit form in most cases. It's just sufficient to use the anti-commutation relations. So let's see how it works here. So otherwise, it would be an awful exercise to substitute here the, you know, multiply 3 4x4 matrices and combine all these four terms would be very difficult. But with the anti-commutators, we can easily easily see that this has the correct form. So, so the idea is that what we do here is we can say take I don't know, one of these terms, which is gamma nu, gamma lambda, gamma nu, the first one. Let's try to bring it to the form in which gamma mu stands in front of two other matrices. So how do we achieve this? We can interchange gamma mu with gamma lambda using anti-commutation relations. Namely, we can write that this is minus gamma nu gamma mu gamma lambda plus gamma nu and then anti-commutator of gamma lambda gamma mu. So this is just the definition of anti-commutator. If you write this term on the right, on the left-hand side, then this would be an identity. Okay, but now the anti-commutator is proportional to the unit matrix. So this term is nothing but 2 g lambda mu gamma nu. Okay, then we apply the same trick once again, so we can interchange gamma nu and gamma mu. And again, so the sign changes as a result. And then we get minus 2 g mu lambda gamma g mu gamma lambda plus 2 g lambda mu gamma nu. So we achieved what we wanted to do. Pulled gamma mu through the other two direct matrices. So the idea here is that you can always interchange the position. If you have a product of direct matrices, you can always interchange their position using anti-commutation relations, which produces terms like that with smaller number of direct matrices. And this is a useful trick in many calculations. Now, in this particular case, you can see that if you apply this transformation to the first term, So the same Dirac matrix structure appears it appears here, gamma mu, gamma nu, gamma lambda is the same term as here, but it has a minus sign. So these two terms will cancel. So if we repeat the same calculation with that term, again we will cancel the product of three gamma matrices will cancel against this term, and we will be left only with the terms that are linear in gamma matrices. So at the end, we only need to keep track of the terms that are linear in gamma matrices. So there will be these two terms, okay, and then there will be two terms from the transformation of this product, and these terms will be okay, so we need to pull gamma mu through the other two Dirac matrices. Each time we anti-commute it through, we pick up the Minkowski matrix. So here we will have minus 2 g mu gamma lambda, and then when we pick up another commutator, we also change the sign. Because, okay, so the here when we anti-commute it once, the sign changed, so the second term is the minus. So there will be also plus 2 g lambda mu gamma mu. So, and you see that this term are equal pairwise, and what we get is 4 g lambda mu gamma nu minus g nu mu gamma lambda. So if you divide by 4, we get precisely this equation, okay, with the sigma defined as an anti-commutator. So this works. And as a result, the Dirac equation will be Lorentz invariant. Yes?
Do I know if that fixture form
for the commutator? Oh, that was on the previous lecture. I'll not repeat the derivation, but in words, you substitute this expansion here and also the expansion of lambda, so lambda. Mu nu is delta mu nu plus omega mu nu. So, and then we equate terms linear in omega in this equation, and that gives basically this condition. So the commutator comes from the expanding the similarity transformation. And then we get this. Okay, so this is how this defines how the Dirac field transforms under Lorentz transformations. So in particular, if you define, so if you eventually would like to apply Noether's theorem to the Dirac field, and in the Noether's theorem we need to know the generator of Lorentz transformations. So that one will be given by the familiar equation that it's x mu d nu minus d nu x mu. But then we'll also have a term which will be minus sigma mu nu. So this defines how the field, transforms under Lorentz transformations. So that would be equal to omega mu nu. Yes, L mu nu psi. So the first term comes from the transformation of the argument of psi. So psi depends on x. X transforms in a certain way. And so as for the scalar field, this induces the transformation of the field with the generator given by this operator. But then there is a direct transformation that acts on the indices of psi. So psi is a spinner. So there will be a term that acts on that by the sigma matrices. So roughly speaking, the first term describes the angular, orbital angular momentum of the field, and the second term describes the spin. Although I should say that the division of the total, so only the total momentum will be conserved. So the division on orbital momentum and spin cannot be done in a Lorentz invariant way. But anyway, so we can write that one half epsilon ijk ljk. So that defined for the scalar field that. So from the first term, we'll get the usual angular momentum of quantum mechanics. And then there will be a second term which we'll denote by IS. Well, I should probably should have written I here as well, just to make so this as an operator, this would be anti-Hermitian in general. So to make it Hermitian, it's convenient to multiply by I. So then the spin operator is one half I over two epsilon ijk. Sigma jk. And now if we substitute the explicit expression for the Dirac matrices, then we will find that the result is diagonal and is given, so for each block, 2 by 2 block, we will get just Pauli matrices. So this is just a spin operator for, so sigma over 2 is a spin operator for spin one half particle. We can conclude that the Dirac field consists of 2 spin one half components. So in a sense, we may expect that the upper and lower components of a spinner, so if it decomposes into two-dimensional components, will describe spin one-half non-relativistic spinners. And so that the Dirac field at the end will describe spin 1/2 particles. Now, from the group theory point of view, this form of this block diagonal form means that spinors transform under reducible representation of the Lorentz group. So this is sigma mu are generators of the Lorentz group acting on Dirac spinors, and see that they're diagonal. In fact, if you consider components with other indices, say with mu nu, where mu can be zero, this will still be the case. So the Lorentz generators are diagonal, are block diagonal with 2 by 2 blocks. So this means that the upper and lower components of the Dirac spinner transform independently under Lorentz transformations. They are not mixed with one another. So we will return to, so this suggests that in principle one can consider a theory where we only have upper or lower components, and that has a chance to be Lorentz invariant on its own, which is indeed the case, and we will return back to this at the end of the lecture. Yes? No, they also don't mix. So if you write down the sigma mu matrices in these 2 by 2 components, they have block diagonal form. So they don't mix upper and lower components of the spin. Okay, so another remark concerns the hermeticity properties of the Dirac matrices, in particular hermeticity properties of the Lorentz transformation. So Lorentz transformation is when acting on the okay, so it's some matrix transformation, but it's not a unitary transformation. So you could have expected that L minus 1 is related in certain way with L dagger, as for unitary transformation they are equal, but for for the Lorentz transformations of the spinors they are related by gamma 0. So this follows from the fact that gamma matrices when under conjugation they acquire 2 factors of gamma 0, and say for infinitesimal transformations this can be easily checked by just using this expression and the explicit form of the generators. So then this means that in particular that to build scalars, so invariants from spinners, is usually we many times we are interested in invariants. When we are dealing with vectors, we know how to build invariants. We just take a scalar product of 2 vectors, and that will be invariant under Lorentz transformations. Now the question is, how do we build invariants from spinors? Well, a natural idea would be to also to build some sort of scalar product of 2 spinors, and then we expect that this will be invariant. So the scalar product of spinors, I mean, the natural natural scalar product spinners are complex vectors, if you wish. So they are complex coulombs of four numbers. And the natural scalar product of this is the Hermitian scalar product of this type. So we may ask if this is a scalar. Well, let's check. So we know that psi transforms to L psi, right? And then psi dagger will transform to psi dagger L dagger, which from this equation we can write as, okay, we can also write this equation as L dagger equals gamma 0 L minus 1 gamma 0. So that will be equal to psi gamma 0 L minus y 1 gamma 0. So then psi dagger psi will transform to psi dagger gamma 0 L minus 1 gamma 0 L psi. And we don't get the same result back, right? So we wanted, if Lorentz transformations were Hermitian, then we wouldn't have had this gamma 0 here, then lambda minus 1 would have canceled with L minus 1 would have canceled with L, and this would have been invariant. But this is not the case precisely because of this gamma 0 matrices here. And so this is not a scalar. It's not a good way to build a quadratic form for spinners. Now, how can we try to fix, how can we fix this problem? Well, we need to somehow cancel this gamma zero that stands here, right? So if it were, I mean, this gamma zero hinders the cancellation of L and L to the minus 1. So if we, from the beginning, insert a gamma 0 here, then we would, then we will be done. So let us try another combination. Namely, let's try psi dagger gamma 0 psi and see what happens. So if you do a Lorentz transformation on that, okay, so psi dagger transforms with gamma 0 L to the minus 1 gamma 0. Then there is gamma 0 that stands here. And then psi transforms with the L. But the gamma 0 squared is 1, and so this is back again psi dagger gamma 0 psi, because this is equal to 1, to unit matrix. So indeed, this is invariant. So this is the correct quadratic form that leaves that produces a Lorentz invariant from spinner and its conjugate. And so it's natural to redefine the rules for conjugation. So Hermitian conjugation of spinners is not so natural from this point of view, because it doesn't produce a scalar when multiplied with the original spinner. A more important operation is the Dirac conjugation. Uh, which is defined with the gamma 0. So we just checked that if we have a spinner, or, well, actually this will be true for two different spinners, then the product of Dirac conjugate and a spinner is a scalar. So it's invariant under Lorentz transformations. And of course, it's also true that if you insert, say, gamma matrix in between, this would be a vector, and so on. So if you insert an arbitrary product of gamma matrices, that will be a tensor with n indices. So in particular, we can define the Dirac Lagrangian by multiplying the Dirac equation with the conjugate spinner from the left. So we can consider the Lagrangian psi bar I gamma mu d mu minus m psi, for so trivial, it's obvious that it gives the Dirac equation when you take variations, because if you take a variation psi bar, then okay, we can consider, as usual, we can consider field and its conjugate as independent variables. So if you take variation with respect to psi bar, then we get the Dirac equation. Okay? And also, this will be a Lorentz scalar because, okay, the second term is a scalar. It's psi bar psi. The first term is psi bar contracted with the derivative, which is a vector, and then this also, there is a gamma matrix, which the index is contracted according to Einstein's rule. So this is invariant. Yes?
Can you make a symmetric tensor out of the
In some sense, no, because let's see. The point is that because of the Dirac algebra, I can always, so if I try to make a symmetric rank 2 tensor gamma mu plus gamma mu, then by Dirac algebra, this would be equal to, so this is psi anticommutator, but then the Dirac algebra tells me that this is proportional to the scale. So, in general, the Dirac algebra automatically anti-symmetrizes all the indices up to tensors of lower rank. Now, okay, so this is the Lagrangian. We can take it as a starting point for quantizing the Dirac field. So, in principle, one could apply the canonical analysis to this Lagrangian, derive Hamiltonian and impose commutation relations, etc., etc. We'll not go through all of this. And instead, we'll take a shortcut by just finding the appropriate solutions of the Dirac equation and interpreting them in terms of particles. But before that, let me make a remark about symmetries. So first of all, the Dirac equation is Lorentz invariant, and it's translationally invariant, and that means that there is some energy momentum tensor associated with the Dirac field. But then there is an extra symmetry. Namely, we can rotate the phase of the Dirac field and the Lagrangian is obviously invariant under this transformation. So if you derive the Noether current that corresponds to this transformation, then it will have a very simple form. So this is just the gamma matrix sandwiched between psi bar and psi. And so what is the meaning of this current? Well, the interpretation is that this is the electric current of the Dirac field. So well, loosely speaking, we can regard psi as a wave function, and so then this psi dagger psi that refuse to be a scalar is basically the density of or density amplitude for the Dirac field. And you see that, okay, so this density turns out to be the zeros component of this current. So J0 is psi bar gamma 0 psi, and this is psi dagger psi. Okay, so indeed we now understand why we failed to in this calculation, because this is not really a scalar, this is a zeros component of a four vector. And this is four vector is actually is a conserved current. So the zeros component of a conserved current is the density of charge. And so you see that the density amplitude of this wave function is the density of this conserved quantity. So we can well associate it with the electric charge of particles that are described by the Dirac field. Or in other words, we can use Dirac field to describe electrically charged particles. So in conclusion, from the Lorentz transformations of the Dirac field, which basically means that the Dirac field has a spin, and from the fact that it carries a conserved charge, we may conclude, or we may expect, that the Dirac field describes spin 1/2 charged particles. In particular, electron is an example of such particle. It has spin 1/2, and it carries an electric charge. So the Dirac field then describes relativistic electrons and positrons. Okay, so of course, to see this, we need to honestly quantize the Dirac field, and then compute the angular momentum operator, compute the charge operator, and act with these operators on single particle states, and see that the eigenvalue is indeed 1/2 for the spin and 1 for electric charge. This is a little bit, it's somewhat longish calculation, so I'll not go through it honestly. I'll just give some. And what we'll do, we will solve the Dirac equation, and then we'll interpret the solutions in terms of particles carrying charge and spin. And then we'll promote the amplitudes for their wave functions into accretion and annihilation operators. And that would define the quantized Dirac field. And this gives the right answer. And OK, but we can keep in mind that there is a more rigorous procedure behind this behind this calculation. So next we'll study the solutions of the Dirac equation. Okay, so the Dirac equation is a linear differential equation with constant coefficients, so it can be solved by Fourier transform. We can write the solution as a superposition of plane waves. And let's call the amplitude of the plane wave as U of P. Now, this U of P is still a map. It is still a spinner, so it has four components. And then the Dirac equation becomes an algebraic equation for this amplitude. So, okay, so it's obtained by replacing id mu by p mu, because the derivative here acts on the exponent, and so id becomes p. And as usual, the dash denotes contraction with the Dirac matrices. So for any four vector in here, we define the contraction with the Dirac matrices. We denote the contraction by putting a slash on the vector. Now, so this is a system of four linear equations, right? So this is a matrix. It acts on a vector with four components. And so this matrix better be degenerate for the equation to have solutions, right? Otherwise, only the degenerate matrix has vectors that of zero eigenvalue. Let us see how it works, starting with a simple case of modes that correspond to static particles. So we can always consider phi mu to be a vector that corresponds to the energy and momentum of a static particle. Okay, so it's easy to show that this equation implies that p squared is equal to m squared. We can multiply from the left by p plus mu, and that would produce p squared minus m squared. We started the derivation of the Dirac equation by that. And okay, so this means that any solution of the Dirac equation also solves the Klein-Gordon equation. So the modes of the Dirac equation are all unshelled. So the p squared is always equals m squared, which indeed describes relativistic particles. Now, we consider particles at rest. So their rest energy is m, and they have zero spatial momentum. And then we can, use the explicit form of the Dirac matrices. So let me write it here. Then we contract P with the gamma matrices. And then we only need gamma zero for the case of the static particle. And so the equation that we get is minus m times the unit matrix in m times the unit matrix. Here is again m. Minus m here, acting on u should give zero. So this is the off-diagonal terms is the contraction of p with gamma, so coming from the first term, and this is the second term in the Dirac equation. So indeed, we get a degenerate matrix, and of course, it's easy to find the solutions of this equation. So basically, the solutions have the form of so you see that the upper and lower components of the spin of this force of the Dirac spinner should be equal to one another, right? So this is the equation that so the Dirac equation just tells us that these two spinners should be equal. The overall normalization is basically the same factor that we had in the Klein-Gordon equation. It's reduced for later convenience. With such normalization, the creation and annihilation operators will be Lorentz invariant. Now, Cs is an arbitrary two-dimensional spinner. So it's an arbitrary two-vector, right? And this means that there are two linearly independent solutions. So when we impose the Dirac equation, we are still left with two-dimensional space of solutions, which means that this matrix has half rank. So it has rank 2, and the total dimension of the spinner is 4. So there are 2 degrees of freedom that are left. Then we can pick up a basis of solutions. So Xi S, we can say that this is 1, 0 for S equals 1. Okay, so Xi 1 is 1, 0, and Xi 2 is 0, 1. And then we can easily interpret what are these wave functions, because, okay, so the spin operator acts on U block diagonally, and the generator, so the spin operator has the usual form of the Pauli matrices, so in the sense these vectors diagonalize their eigenvalues of the third component of the spin, so they describe a particle at rest that has given projection, Z projection of the spin. Okay, so this would be correspond to spin up, so, and this would correspond to spin down particle. So and this is the sigma Z projection of the spin. Okay, now we can go to the general case. So to treat the general case, it's convenient to write the Dirac matrices in, so to introduce some common notations for the 2x2 blocks of the Dirac matrices. So we introduce the relativistic generalization of the Pauli matrices. Now here bar is not any kind of complex conjugation, it's just a notation. So the sigma matrices are and they appear, they are quite commonly used in quantum field theory. In particular, they are very useful in dealing with supersymmetric field theories. I'll not talk about supersymmetry in this course, but it is more convenient to write, to separate the upper and lower component of spinors, and then one is dealing with these sigma matrices. So they also satisfy a nice algebra. So which can be checked explicitly, right? So for Pauli matrices, if mu and nu are I and j, this is just the usual anti-commutation relation for sigma I, sigma j. And they're also satisfied for all four components. Okay? And then using these relations, it's really simple to check the anti-commutation relations of the Dirac matrices written in this block diagonal form. Okay, so now the Dirac equation is written in can be written like that. So we separated the upper and lower components of the spinner. Let's denote them by U left and U right. And this is the matrix equation for these components. So, okay, so this is a set of two equations, if you wish, on two-dimensional vectors. And so the first equation can be solved in terms of UL because it multiplies the unit matrix. So it just tells that UL is 1 over M sigma dot P acting on U right. Okay. And then the second equation is identity, which can be checked with the help of this anti-commutation relations. So again, we can say that U right is arbitrary, and then once you're given U right, you can compute U left. So we have a two-dimensional space of solutions. However, it's more convenient to write it in a more symmetric form. So we can say that U right is equal to square root of P dot sigma acting on Xi. Now it contains a square root of some matrix. And in principle, taking a square root of a matrix is an ambiguous operation. But in principle, so this is defined by continuity starting with the rest frame. Okay, so in the rest frame, this becomes a unit matrix. Then taking the square of the unit matrix is easy. And then if we go, we can think of slowly increasing the momentum. And then by continuity, we can define the square root. So in this case, the solution can be written in a rather symmetric form. Where Xi S is the same set of vectors. So this is basically the same formula as here, but boosted into an arbitrary reference frame. So the physical meaning of this solution is the same. So this is actually, this is just the same solution, but in a different reference frame if you wish. So it describes a particle moving with four momentum P, whose Z component of spin in its rest frame is equal to plus or minus 1/2. And this gives half of the general solutions of the Dirac equation. So why half? We'll discuss a little bit later, but let me just give some useful identities for this solution. So in particular, the wave functions are normalized to to 2m. It's easy to check this equation in the rest frame. And in the arbitrary frame, it requires a little calculation, which you're suggested to do on your own on the tutorials. Then if you compute instead the product of the usual Hermitian product, which is not Lorentz invariant, then it produces the energy. So these are consistent equations. So consistent in the sense that the left and right hand sides have correct transformation properties. So the Lorentz invariant product gives you mass, which is Lorentz invariant, and this Hermitian product gives you energy, which is this also the zeros component of some four vector. Then there is another equation that's important. If you sum over polarizations, the second equation is, no, they're both wrong, actually. There is a, so they're diagonal in this spin indices. So this is, S is, okay, so S here is a label that denotes the solutions, right? So there is a solution with a spin up and spin down, and also U's have spinor indices alpha and beta. So here we contract the alpha and beta indices, we sum over them. Now we can do the opposite thing. We can keep the alpha and beta indices and sum over the spin labels. And so this gives a very simple combination of the Dirac matrices. Okay, so this is not the complete set of solutions of the Dirac equation. This is just a half of solutions. Well, why half? So when we started in the rest frame, we assumed that our four momentum has positive energy component. So it's zeros compound was just mass, which we assume to be positive. That describes a physical particle. But of course, when we are solving the Dirac equation, there are also solutions with negative energy. And we know how to interpret them in field theory. So in field theory, the positive energy modes correspond to creation operators and negative energy modes to annihilation operators. So we need these solutions. They are physical. So they're usually denoted by letter V and have this form. So they're P dot sigma nu S square root P dot sigma bar nu S. And so the way it works is that, okay, so if you have some four vector P with positive energy, then we can change the sign of this vector, and that would produce the vector with negative components. So you just insert a minus sign here. And this is equivalent to changing the sign of the right component of the spinner. So we just put this minus one sign here, and we get another solution of the Dirac equation, in which p squared would be replaced by, p squared will be the same, but p will be replaced by minus p. So nu, this is not nu, this is eta. Eta is the same as xi, so it has plus 1, 0, or 0 plus 1 components depending on s. We introduced another letter to emphasize that there are more degrees of freedom. So this is independent from the positive energy solutions. There are also the same normalization conditions, the S of P VR of P is equal to minus 2m delta SR, where V is dagger of P VR of P is equal to 2 times E of P delta SR, assuming that E is positive. And then the summation over spin VS alpha of P V bar S beta of P gives another combination of Dirac matrices, so it's basically the matrix that stands in the Dirac equation. Okay, so in total we found that for each four momentum, there are four solutions of the Dirac equation. So spin up and spin down positive frequency modes, and then spin up and spin down negative frequency modes. So in total, there are four degrees of freedom, and they exactly correspond to the possibility to have to spin one half, to the degrees of freedom of spin one half, charge one particle. So they describe states with spin plus one half, spin minus one half, and then charge plus one half, and then spin minus one half, spin plus one half for charge minus one. So they describe particles and their antiparticles. In particular, they can describe electrons and positrons. And in some sense, the antiparticles, they come out automatically when we consider negative energy modes. So at the time when Dirac wrote down the equations, positrons haven't yet been discovered. And this was one of the predictions of his theory, that electrons must have antiparticles with negative charge. In fact, it's a very general principle in quantum field theory. Always, if we have some sort of particles, there are antiparticles associated with them, which have opposite charges but the same spin. Now, for the Klein-Gordon field, we didn't find any antiparticles, because, in a sense, the Klein-Gordon particles are antiparticles of their own. So there are particles that their own antiparticles. And, one example that we are all familiar with are photons. So photons are their own antiparticles. And it has to do with the fact that their field is a Hermitian operator. So the Klein-Gordon field is a Hermitian operator by itself. But then in the Dirac equation, we have to assume that the Dirac spinner is a complex object. So when we quantize it, it does not become it becomes an operator that is not, I mean, it's not Hermitianly conjugate to itself. And so there is a conjugate, separate conjugate field. And therefore, we have particles and antiparticles that are different. And it also has to do with the fact that we have charge. So since a Dirac field carries a charge, there should be antiparticles with negative charge. Yes?
And what did you borrow the complex Klein-Gordon field when we did the negative current? So we calculated, we saw that it had a complex phase symmetry as
yes.
well. Yes. Then calculated the negative current from that. And that associated negative current can couple, you can use that to give complex scalar theory with an electric charge.
That's right. So if you quantize this complex scalar field, it also describes particles and antiparticles. So it describes 2 degrees of freedom per momentum. So this can be interpreted as positively and negatively charged particles. So, okay, so I stop here and I hope I have 1 minute because in the last lecture there was a question how to compute the dimension of the scalar field. I promised to answer it. So here is an answer. So the scalar field operator, and so schematically it's written, let's consider the representation where it has a three momentum integration. Then it has, okay, this normalization factor 1 over 2e. And then there are creation and annihilation operators with some exponential factors that I don't write. So I only write the factors that have dimension. Okay? So now how to calculate the dimension of this total expression? Well, we need to understand what is the dimension of the creation and annihilation operators. Since they commute on the delta function, and this is a three-dimensional delta function, so if we integrate it over three volume, it will give one, three momentum volume. So the dimension of the right-hand side is equal to minus three, right? So the integral of that is dimensional, dimensionless. So it compensates for the dimension of the integration measure. So this means that the dimension of A and A dagger is minus 3/2 in the units of energy. So the dimension of 1 over 2EP is minus 1/2. And the dimension of D3P is 3. So the dimension of the field then is equal to minus 3/2 minus 1/2 plus 3, which is equal to 1. So this is the result. The dimension of the scalar field is 1. It has the same dimension as mass. Okay, so that's it for today. Thank you. I guess we see each other.